We went to summer camp when they were little. Or who sent their kids to summer camp. Good at showing of hands. Maybe you had the redheaded geek like I did as a counselor one time. But we'll not digress on that. That'll be another sermon. But there are all kinds of memories, I'm sure, that instantly come up when you think about summer camp. Milestones and developments. And we just sent Nevin George. They just returned from a month in North Carolina where they had lots of sailing and boating and all these land activities and sea activities. And it was just an incredible break from living in our beautiful area of the Blue Ridge. And I have to admit that I caught myself explaining where they are in camp to somebody because I love all those activities. And B, I was just sort of beaming about all their little ranks they were getting. But while we were sending them to camp for a month, how cool is that? And little did I know that I was just completely falling into the performative trap. Right? The performative trap. This trap that is everything is about how are you progressing? What are you achieving? Are you going like this or like this? Don't be going like this, in other words. In other words, the notion that everything we do has to have the Greek word telos, or fulfillment. It's got to have a purpose and a goal. Everything, then, is about achievement. And what was the convicting piece for me was reading an article last week in the Wall Street Journal by Rick Cohen. It was entitled, Life Lessons Learned in Summer Camp. And he writes, in the manner of a public school or an army base, what I learned was usually not what was being taught. I learned how to form alliances, survive a bully, win a fight against a stronger person, spark a softball rally, sneak off the grounds and into the Eagle River Taverns without leaving a trace, gamble, chew tobacco, throw a knife, December, a daddy, long legs, barter, and bluff. He finishes. Notice that Cohen doesn't crow about the ladders of achievement that he accomplished, or the mastery of skill, whether he talks about what it's like to navigate a real life with other people. I think that's why George was so happy when he admitted 2 nights ago that he watched a lot of NBA G Leagues with his counselor on their iPhone underneath the covers at night. No screens allowed, allegedly, except for this case. But, that tension, right? The tension that article draws out, or even my own way of thinking about this, is that we get stuck into thinking about everything as a performance or as something to be mastered or to achieve. Right? We want to measure, we want to market, we want to control it. Whether it's summer camp, church, our professional lives, or our family gatherings, we are more than ever in our world hardwired to measure and to strive and to accumulate. Mastery, optimizing our performances. How many people have read articles just in the last week where it talks about, here's how to optimize your life? That was the cover of Men's Health this past month. I haven't read it, but on the front, it's like optimizing your breakfast. I mean, really? Isn't it just Cheerios and like an egg? But no, I mean, there's like different things you should do on different days. I mean, we take everything down to this incredible intensity now about how we can grab that brass ring, if you follow that image of those old-fashioned merry-go-rounds where pulling the brass ring gives you the extra ride. We just want to keep doing it. This plays out again back in the camp metaphor. At George's camp, Seagull, I was talking to a counselor at pickup on Friday, and he told me that this year, in the last 56 years, was the hardest year for them to train and equip new counselors. They don't have the people. And a lot of it, I think there is COVID, but not everything in the world we can blame on COVID. Sorry, right? I think the other part, this counselor was talking about it, is that now in youth sports, if you're not playing all year round, well, you could kiss your college scholarship goodbye. If you're not doing travel this and travel that or private lessons here or there, then there's no way you're going to be a varsity player, even in high school. And so especially for young boys, they can't take a summer off from their sport. Isn't that sad? I mean, yeah, hey, can I get an amen? I mean, and at the same time, right, it's the culture, and we're all guilty of it, okay? This isn't a finger wagging at other people. We're all guilty of it. I mean, I take Fred the other day to, like, the Roanoke Valley Chess Club. He didn't want to go. He wanted to play with his friends. I'm like, he's going to get good at chess. I mean, we all fall into these traps. We all fall into this trap. So what is the purpose? We got to master and fulfill. We got to progress and grow and achieve. We got to be better today than we were yesterday. We got to optimize ourselves. We got to be like Moore's Law. George Moore, the founder of Intel, came up with this law in the 60s. It said that a processor should double every 2 years in computers. Now I think it's like every 2 weeks. But still, like, that's ingrained in our culture, right? You should be that much faster now than you were 2 years ago. And all of us, in some ways, consciously or unconsciously, fall into these performative traps. We really do. And it's become our default reading. It's the way we read the Bible many times. It's the way, in other words, we approach God many times. Now, the gospel that we just heard today is pretty familiar, especially if you think about the nomenclature, right? Mary and Martha. And we typically diagram it like this. Here comes Jesus. He's a close friend of both Mary and Martha and Lazarus. So we don't get Lazarus in our Luke story. And he's a special guest. So then we have Martha going over the top with the fancy candlesticks and the Chateaubriand and the nice wine and appetizers and whatever else you'd have for your finest guests. And there's Mary in her perceived slothliness, just sort of hanging out in repose by Jesus. In other words, Martha's doing all the work, and she's mad about it because the special guest is here, and she might even be behind cooking the beef. And so we typically then follow these two expository angles on the story. The first is, Mary is a worker, and Martha is a worker, and Mary is the contemplative. These two are at odds, but both are needed in the world. Now, I think that's a perfectly nice understanding. I think it's true. I think some people are more geared towards action, and some people are more geared towards being potted plants. There's no doubt about it. And I won't say which one is better, because they're just more people. And I think there's a good theological point there, which is that we both, that all Mary and Martha's have different strengths, just like we all do. And that is the truth. But that's also not the gospel. That's not the gospel. Another way that we think about it is, well, Martha is distracted with busyness. And this sort of passive-aggressive side is sort of all of our worst sides. And Mary is the true exemplar, the holy one. Be more like Mary, this sort of sermon angle would go, the holy one. But there's always the carve out, right? Because in churches, we still need people to bring food to the potlucks. So we still say, but God bless those Marthas in the world, right? So we still try to hold them both together. Because again, that's a truth. We need both Marys and Marthas. And it's also true that many days all of us are distracted by what we're doing, right? Has any of your spouses or your friends or your loved ones or anybody said, I just don't think you're hearing me? I know that's never happened to you all. It has happened to me a couple of times, right? I just don't think you're paying attention to me. There's a great ad in the New Yorker on a cartoon that had a guy eating lunch by one of those, like, ping pong boards, you know, like you can play by yourself, ping pong table, so you flip it up like this. And the caption said, this is what it's really like to eat lunch with someone who's checking their cell phone. Right? I mean, we all get distracted. Pull out your phone. Right? All of us are guilty of this. Or we're also sometimes all Marys. Those are great moments many times, right? Where we're sort of soaking up the Lord and resting in his yoke. Now, to come clean, we're not one or the other. Right? We're humans. And as such, we participate in both of these dynamics. And yet it's the Marthas that continue to get sort of the focus of this. Like, don't be a Martha. Don't be the drip, drip of do, be now. Because that leads to measuring and scorekeeping in our lives. But the plain reading of this text, isn't just to bash the Marthas, nor is it just to uphold the Marys. Because it's similar. You got to go back to this summer camp idea that the gospel is often not found in the plain reading between Mary and Martha. It's found in the in-betweens, in the subtexts, not, in other words, on the scorecard of who's doing well and who's doing poorly. And that's the good news, is that the parable actually has nothing to do with Mary and Martha, and everything to do with Jesus and his relationship with us. Jesus himself tells us this morning, there is need of only one thing. He further says that Martha, gotta bash her for a second, sorry, is illustrative of why this need is so important. Because we're all guilty of falling into this do busyness trap. And the one thing that we need, give you one guess, it's one word, starts with G, grace, right? It is the one thing we actually need. It is the one thing that we actually need in this world. Nothing else, not one single iota of anything. Because grace encompasses God's kingdom, where there's no scoreboards, there's no achievement, there's no pressure on us, there's no more command to be a Martha or to be a Mary. There is nothing but the blood of the Lamb that wipes the scoreboard clean once and for all. There is nothing but God's grace and the good news of the gospel. Because God's grace is the only power that can change our hearts and reconcile us to God and each other. This is what Robert Capon said, grace is good news and everything else is not. It's true. The irony is that grace is the one vehicle that allows us to freely achieve those things that we actually want to achieve. It's the one moment that gives us a true restart in our lives, that really reveals, that extracts even better our sense of self-condemnation and provides us with a sense of love and acceptance. It gives us the ultimate restart. That's the one thing. That's all Jesus wants us to know today, is the power of his love and the grace given from the cross. There's an incredible scene that shows the power of grace to restart and to give you new life. And it comes in the opening scene of Victor Hugo's Les Miserables. If anybody has seen the play or the movie, you already know exactly what I'm getting ready to say. It's so powerful. Jean Valjean is a homeless convict. He's been in prison for 19 years. He's hungry, he's destitute, and he's broken. He knocks on a church door one cold evening, and the bishop of Digne invites him in. They eat together, and they drink together. And then Jean Valjean gets into this big, massive bed that he hadn't slept in a real bed in over 19 years. And he wakes up in the middle of the night, and he decides to creep down into the kitchen, where he robs the bishop of the finest silver in the house. At that very moment, the bishop gets up hearing this noise, and Valjean punches him in the head, and he falls down. Jean Valjean is off with the bishop's, the church's silver. And the next morning, he's brought back to the bishop's house by the authorities, who have found the church's silver. This arresting scene ends with the authorities giving this convict over to the bishop, saying, "We have all your silver, sir. It's coming back." The bishop looks at Jean Valjean. He looks at his silver. He looks at the authorities. And he looks again at Jean Valjean and he says, I'm so glad you came back, Valjean, because you forgot the silver candlesticks. He grabs the two silver candlesticks and he stuffs them in his bag. He thanks the authorities for bringing him back because he wouldn't want Jean Valjean to leave without his candlestick. And he says, good day to them all. Valjean's life at that moment is permanently altered by the act of grace. And the bishop sings this hymn as Valjean leaves. It's a hymn not just for Jean Valjean, but for all of us. By the witness of the martyrs, by the passion and the blood, God has raised you out of darkness.